Hi, everybody. Welcome to Who Cares About the Rock, a podcast about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I'm your host, Joe Quazala. I know absolutely too much about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and that is my cross to bear. With me, as always, is my co-host. She is the skeptic, the voice of the people, the little devil on my shoulder, Kristen Studdard. Hey, Kristen.
It's here to stay. Hello. Hello, Joe.
Kristen, you are joining us from what was supposed to be and what still will be a vacation, but for the next hour.
Truly. And also, yeah, I'm in Central California. I'm near Morro Bay with my boyfriend's family, and it's usually about 70 degrees maximum. And this morning it's like 78 degrees. And so everyone's like, we got to hit the beach. And I was like, cool, I'm going to just head back to the house and talk about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
I have early inf June lens to deal with.
They were like, what are you talking about? I was like, hell if I know.
Well, we are, it's the last week of early inf June lints, our bad pun month, celebrating the category and inductees' early influence through the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And we have a great guest with us. I'm very excited that she's joining us. And you know we love a guest that comes with a strong recommendation from our friend Daphne Brooks.
Absolute so, all-star guest.
Setting the bar very high.
Yes.
She's an author. She's a scholar. Let's bring her in here. Gail Wald. Hey, Gail.
Hey.
Thank you for joining us. Let's give the people, since you're new to the show, a little bit of a background on who you are. We might as well start off with the fact that prior to her induction, you wrote a biography on Sister Rosetta Tharpe.
That's right. So I teach at George Washington University. It's hard. It's a hard act to follow Daphne Brooks, but I'll do my best. I'm happy to be recommended by her. Let's just put it that way. I published a biography of Rosetta Tharpe in 2007. It's called Shout, Sister, Shout, The Untold Story of Rock and Roll Trailblazer Sister Rosetta Tharpe. It's actually coming out in a second edition, I think in 2023, but partly because the story has changed so much since when I first published the book.
Well, I mean, she's in the Rock Hall, which is probably the biggest news. I'm kidding.
The untold story thing still kind of, you know, untold story is a little bit of it's a cliche that tells a reader what they think they're going to get, but right. The story is not quite untold anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Here's a weird thing that kind of surprised me. I was watching the movie Death on the Nile, and there's a character who isn't technically Sister Rosetta Tharpe, but she is, and she's singing exclusively Sister Rosetta Tharpe songs. And I was shocked, like this big studio movie, I just wasn't expecting it.
Yeah, I wonder if that was, okay, full disclosure, I've known about this film since before it came out because everyone who knows my investment in Rosetta Tharpe let me know about it. And I've been like, I don't know why, I'm just resistant to seeing it. There's no reason. So
I mean, looking at the actors, there's some reasons that you would want to stay away from it.
I will say that the woman who plays the character, the Rosetta Tharpe character, is the best actress in that movie. I didn't think the movie was, I watched it when I had COVID. So maybe, you know, I had like a bit of a foggy brain at that point, but I remember being like, that woman is so like beautiful and charismatic. There was like every time she was on screen, I was like, the movie should be about this woman, a character that is like not really even in the source material because they
isn't it a Kenneth Branagh production?
Yes.
Yeah, he directed it.
Yeah, so I wondered, you know, he's kind of the right vintage to be someone who might have known about Rosetta Tharpe when he was young, or like kind of that generation that really was into American blues gospel blues. So I wonder if there's a Kenneth Branagh in
the people that. Who went on to, oh my gosh, what is it, Skiffle?
Exactly.
the people who went on to Skiffle. These are things I do know. Can you believe I remembered that? I almost said Skitter, but then I remembered it's Skiffle.
Yeah, and I'm impressed.
Thank you.
But yeah, so I mean, you kind of told the story when it was quote unquote untold, and then, you know, about 11 years later she was inducted into the Hall. Was there any personal involvement in terms of,
you mean my giant lobbying campaign? No.
Yeah.
Yeah. Would you like to take credit? I will say Joe is someone who likes to take credit for the Hall noticing things. So you'd be in good company if you in any way were like, you know, it might have been me.
Well, the book definitely, look, if I hadn't written, it's not like Rosetta Tharpe was totally forgotten or that the story was untold. It was untold for certain audiences, and she was certainly not known. But then after the book was published, you know, there were this like kind of slow kind of gathering of steam around her. And I think at a certain point, which started with just a fan who was kind of an entrepreneur in Philadelphia, was like, oh, I read Best your book. She's in an, no, not, yes, if only, yes, I would drop that name if I could. Was like, oh, we should do a tribute concert and raise money for a headstone. So I was helpful with that, but I'm not a producer of concerts. And he did that. And of course, the concert, which was lovely and amazing, the Dixie Hummingbirds were there, Odetta was there. Of course, a concert at a small club in suburban Philadelphia doesn't even break even. So it didn't quite raise money for a gravestone, but eventually people chipped in for a gravestone. Her friend was located, Rosetta Tharpe's friend, to write the epitaph, and kind of like it took off like a little locomotive, you know, gathering steam. And there was a documentary that came from a British documentarian. And, you know, when more and more musicians start shouting her out, and, you know, recently I had a reason to go back to watch Johnny Cash's induction ceremony.
From like Johnny 92. Cash, yeah.
He spends like, you know, he doesn't have that much time up there. I think he spends like 45 seconds or a minute talking about Rosetta Tharpe.
Wow.
And really that should have been enough to get folks thinking, like, this was Johnny Cash, and he was like, this is my favorite performer. So, you know, like Johnny Cash said that well before I started researching Rosetta Tharpe.
You're right. And a good 26 years before she eventually was inducted should not have taken that long.
Right.
Were you involved? Like, did you write the essay in the program?
I did get to write the essay. You know, they don't pay you for that, but you get a ticket to go.
Ooh, now do you get a good ticket? Were you like at a table kind of ticket, or do you get a nose?
You're at a table with the other writers. You're at a table with Kulitz, which is fun because everyone's totally, you know, you get the commentary.
Yes, everybody's, it would be like sitting next to us, but we're in the nosebleeds generally.
but you also get the good food.
Okay, you get the dinner.
Like you get the food. I mean, I've only done it once, but I was impressed with you. There was a bento box of dessert.
Okay. Oh, okay. See, all right. But was there like a $14 Bud Light? Okay.
I didn't have to pay, so I don't know.
Okay. Yeah. So that's the difference between our experience, I suppose, than the experience at the tables. Okay. So that's awesome that you got to go and see the induction. 2018 Sister Rosetta Tharpe, I'd say was a real highlight of it. Otherwise kind
that
of
was a dismal year in my opinion, as far as the induction ceremony was concerned, but the highlight was absolutely Sister Rosetta Tharpe. And then Nina Simone's induction were both handled quite well that year.
You know, and even if you weren't having, you know, like been in the room and trying to be objective about it, even if you had been there for some of the other groups, Brittany Howard and Felicia Collins were so good. And, you know, that performed clearly, like people were energized by that. They didn't necessarily come to see Rosetta Tharpe inducted. Maybe they wanted to see Lauryn Hill induct Nina Simone. Mm-hmm. But I felt like, wow, the people did not come for this performance, this induction, but you could tell that like people like woke up.
That's really cool. Even if it's like a Bon Jovi fan, you know, it's like that night, it's like there's so, and it's funny to think of like, thank you for writing this article. Here's tickets to a Bon Jovi concert. on some level, that was your...
You know, the only thing that disappointed me, if I can say that about the night, is there was, and this isn't, you know, this isn't the fault of the producers of the thing, but there was like no connection really between Nina Simone, Rosetta Tharpe, and the other, I think all living, mostly living recipients who were inductees. So it was like, you know, what you wanted was like Johnny Cash there to say, oh, you know, this is important. I felt like there were like two different, you know, I wish there had been like more of a bridge made.
Right, yeah. Because there's definitely one to draw if you make the effort. Are you going to go to the induction this year because you're writing the essay on Elizabeth Cotton?
I don't go unless I write.
So it seems like you. If you want to accept payment, you better take that ticket.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, I think if I could swing the airfare, I think, you know, airfare from DC to Los Angeles is like $5,000.
Yeah, no, yeah, no, flights, no. Are, flights are so cheap right now. Just popping around the country. Oh my gosh.
But, yeah, so I'll try to make it, you know, if I could afford to, I only get the ticket, not the flight or the hotel. So
I, yeah, that's really too bad.
yeah,
but I'll try to go.
If I can ask some kind of minutia that you might think is uninteresting, but is a little, you might also say is the bread and butter of this show. What is the process of getting to write that article? Like, who reaches out to you? And, you know, was this an established relationship because you had written the Rosetta Tharpe article? And then, like, if that's the case, then who reached out to you then?
So the fantastic cultural critic, music critic, Holly George Warren, has been doing this for a while. So she edits works for the Rock Hall to produce the booklet that people mm-hmm. get. So she's like the main editor of it. And I think we knew of each other from overlapping worlds. We know each other. And she knew I wrote a biography of Rosetta Tharpe. So it made sense, I think.
Okay.
She's an excellent, you know, she's the brains behind the putting that together.
Right. And so, I mean, it's obvious, you're kind of an obvious pick to write the one for Rosetta Tharpe because of there's a published book. But for Elizabeth Cotton, what was, why do you think they reached out to you?
I don't know. You know, okay. So right now I'm working on a biography of the eminent children's musician, Ella Jenkins. Mm-hmm. Who's in Chicago, who's 97 years old, who's Folkways best-selling artist of all time, who invented children's music. That's a little inflated, but not quite. So at first I was like, oh, Libba Cotton, you know, I don't know. And then I realized that Libba Cotton is like in the Venn diagram between Rosetta Tharpe and Ella Jenkins, the project that I'm working on now. There's this kind of interesting overlap, and actually it was really super, actually the person I'm, this didn't make it into my, I only had, you know, like 1,000 words, so it's not a, it's like 4 double-spaced pages, so it's not a lot of manuscript, but it turns out that Ella Jenkins, when Libba Cotton came to it was the first University of Chicago Folk Festival in 1961, and Libba Cotton was a featured performer, and she was kind of getting out there for the first time. Black woman, 1961 Chicago, who did she stay with? Ella Jenkins. Oh, so wow. I got to ask Ella, wow. And they didn't really know each other. And Libba Cotton is, Ella is 97 now, and she was mm-hmm. born in 1924. Libba Cotton was born in the 19th century. Right. So she was like a quarter of a century older than Ella then. So she would have been, like another generation. But Libba, and so I asked Ella, you know, what does she remember about Libba Cotton? And she was like, oh, she was really interesting. And then she told me, this didn't get to make it in, that she had the most musical snore of anyone she's ever met.
Wow.
Wow.
She'll never forget how musically she snored.
That's incredible. What a great piece of information.
That's a nugget for everybody out there. Okay.
Did that make the essay?
BTS. It's not in. She only had so much manuscript, and the snore didn't get in. The secondhand telling of the snore did not make it.
I say release the snore cut. Well, that's so great.
I just really quickly want to talk back to Rosetta Tharpe before we move, because I feel like we're going to mm-hmm. move forward sure. from now. Something I didn't know, I was just doing a quick Google about Rosetta Tharpe. I was thinking about her while we were talking, and an article came out this morning saying the artist that it's on Vulture, 8 a.m. drop this morning, the influences of Rosetta Tharpe, because I guess she's in this new Baz Luhrmann Elvis movie.
Yes. Yola. Yes.
A woman named Yola, a British singer from Massive Attack, plays her in the new Elvis movie. And so she's going to even get more. You thought Death on the Nile had something. This woman's actually playing her and named.
Yeah.
Right.
It's a big deal. It's a big deal for Rosetta, you know, for people to, because Yola's popularity, the splash around this movie, I'm really curious to see how it works. The trailer looked a little iffy to me.
So yeah.
We'll see.
It looks frantic.
Baz Luhrmann movie? Okay. I believe it. I guess I can believe it.
It also looked to me like Elvis. It's maybe that's the word. Elvish.
Yeah.
That, like, yes. You know, like kind of like, you know, intense, a lot focused on the actor's body, that kind of stuff. And so I'm really curious to see, does the world need Elvis fetish now? And if you're going to do it, can you do it in a way that makes us feel like we need it? We need this version to be told.
Yeah.
I'm curious about it.
I wonder. I haven't seen literally anything about it other than we're in a group text about trying to all go see it together.
Yeah, right.
That's all I know. And I think I lost in that battle. Joe's going out of town next week. And so they're going to go see it this week while I'm out of town, which is very rude.
Likely. We'll see. We'll see how it all pans out. Or if people want to go back to the movies to see it again again.
We're back to the movies. The movies are back.
It comes out this Friday?
Yes, yeah. It does.
Yeah,
it's coming out. That's wild. Yeah, that Sister Rosetta Tharpe is in a
she's 8 a.m.
second
drop
movie
vulture
within about a year or so.
That's right. And Lizzo's guitarist, when Lizzo played SNL, there's been a lot of name drops in a great way. When Lizzo played SNL, her guitarist Celise, who goes by Celise, one name, wore an outfit that was like clearly inspired by Rosetta Tharpe and had a Gucci guitar strap that said sister on it.
Oh, that's
that was
awesome.
A nice little for Lizzo fans. Mm-hmm. Janelle Monáe and Lizzo had this talk together in this online magazine called Them. And they talked about Rosetta as this influence on a new generation of women, especially mm-hmm. Black queer women, non-binary people. So, you know, interesting. I think these like contemporary artists who are like talking about her is making it interesting.
Yes.
Yeah. And what a welcome conversation.
Yes.
And now Big Mama Thornton needs to get a freaking movie deal or something.
I'm curious.
Like, what do we have to do?
She's not in the Elvis.
That was going to be my question. Cause she seems like a much more direct, influence when it comes to, you know, specifically the song Hound Dog, obviously.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
And it doesn't, we have no intel. I guess we would have heard if
I don't think so. I don't think since I've been like, well, I'm not the expert on this, but I've been following this Baz Luhrmann film for a long time because I knew that, you know, so, and I haven't seen anything about, so it's kind of interesting the choice, like Little Richard's in it. There's a Little Richard character. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And there's another, I feel like there's another one. Clearly I'm unprepared for this discussion.
No, hey, this portion, nobody's seen the movie. We don't know.
No,
I Googled the article exists. That's all I know.
I think I want to say there's some nod to her, but it might not be like, I think maybe her version of Hound Dog is in the movie or on the soundtrack or something. So I got distracted because it was like Doja Cat shuns Elvis.
Yeah, I just
Big
saw
Mama
that
Thornton.
And I was like, wait, what? And then no, but that already came out. Elvis biopic finds its Little Richard, Big Mama Thornton.
Oh wait,
and
so
more.
It seems like there is.
Oh, she is in there.
Yeah, it seems. It seems like she might be in there. I'm looking at
a shadow and act.
Shanka Dukure is the actress. Yeah, so it looks like Big Mama might, in fact, be in this movie.
All right, we take back everything, so you'll just have to edit it all out.
Yeah, but let's talk about this kind of category in general and like what has happened to it and, you know, where it's at now and where it might go. Because, you know, this was relatively established pre-rock acts. This is the early influence category in the Rock Hall. This is where pre-rock acts go, and you can kind of, it's maybe a slightly blurry line, but you can kind of determine who that qualifies for. Robert Johnson,
right.
Acts like that who are pretty definitively before the rock explosion, but the category has always been kind of flexible. Howlin' Wolf was inducted as an early influence, and even though you could obviously look at when he was releasing music and who his peers were, and, you know, why is Muddy Waters in as a performer, but Howlin' Wolf is in as an early influence. And then they started to get looser with it in more recent years. 2009,
yes.
We saw Wanda Jackson,
right.
Who that's you know, she's early rock era. Freddie right. King in 2012. Similarly, I think his first recordings are like 1960 or 1959. And then last year was really when it feels like the category exploded in terms of its definition.
Kraftwerk
yeah. and Gil Scott-Heron.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, all right, that it feels like we've taken a very sharp turn into reimagining what this category could mean. And I'd say, you know, there are sticklers who might say this is against the whole idea behind it. But also, if you think about when the Rock Hall started inducting people in 1986, and if you take, okay, say 1936 was 50 years before right. then. And now that we're in 2022, 50 years before is, you know, 1972. So, you know, is this a thing that can shift and it continues to make sense, or is it completely insane?
Joe, you know how I feel, which right. is who cares? Mm-hmm. Put them in however you got to get them in. Just do it. Let's just do this. Come on.
Yeah, well, it's like if you're putting in, like, obviously Kraftwerk and Gil Scott-Heron in particular, when they were inducted, it seemed like the emphasis was on their influence on hip hop. Mm-hmm. And it was an acknowledgement that the Rock Hall was going, you know, we're going down this hip hop road. We have for a while. That year in particular, we saw for the first time two hip hop inductees, LL Cool J and Jay-Z. So it felt like worth an acknowledgement. But when you start to do this, you also start to wonder, like, kind of any artist can be designated an influence if you want to be creative enough.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to even think about this because it's called the Rock Hall, Rock and Roll Hall. But the whole originating way of like separating a period was so arbitrary mm-hmm. and really mm-hmm. based on like racialized cultural politics that it's like impossible. I mean, I kind of like with Kristen, like we have this thing, but like the idea of Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was so in some ways arbitrary and in some ways intentional that like there's nothing to be done with it except be in this mess. And so early influences, like it's so weird then early influences like keeps marching forward mm-hmm. as the definition of rock becomes like
more malleable, more malleable. So
like, what are we even talking about? What's the early, and you know, the early influence also, you know, especially in the Rock Halls. Well, I don't know. I have to go back and look. Joe, you know this, mm-hmm. but like it's been this repository of, you know, a lot of African-American musicians, you know, so it ends up having this, you know, like you can't help but notice.
Well, and you know, we have had this discussion before too, with the regards to the idea of the front door versus the side door with the hall, meaning more like getting voted in on the ballot is kind of considered the front door in a lot of ways. You know, that's like you're going in the way that God intended, that Jan intended, you know, but like, then sometimes they'll try to get an artist in or an act in, and then they'll put them in through kind of the side door induct them. Like they did that for Nile Rodgers with musical excellence and things like that after having him on the ballot so many times and things like that. And it can feel like it's a slight, you know, it can feel like this isn't official or whatever. And it's like, it also kind of shows you what is going on with the voters as well. And kind of one of the major problems is that the voters are not diverse. And so like inducts like, et cetera, et cetera. And then also like the idea that like pre-rock and roll was when rock was black. And then when it was white, that's when it became rock and roll. You know,
yeah,
it's like before then it was black music. And then after it, it's rock and roll. And rock and roll is for white men. Or I guess in the 50s, it was for white teens, but you know, of both genders,
right.
Just and two genders only. I'm sorry.
That's exactly the problem. Like,
you yeah. know,
if you call it rock and, you know, the Rock Hall or Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and if you predicate it on like, when does it become like a cultural icon? Then you're talking about, right. It like there's no way of like the foundational moment is kind of problematic. Mm-hmm. So there's no way out of it. So right. We're just living with the imperfect Rock Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And we really are living with the imperfect Rock Hall. I'm living with it every week somehow, even when I'm on vacation.
Now more than ever.
But Liba Cotton's story is, you know, I did a week long dive into Liba Cotton in a way that I had never before. And that story is kind of incredible. And it also, Liba Cotton like ties together in a really interesting way, kind of blues, folk, you know, what's called folk music and blues and skiffle, because Liba Cotton comes like influences rock first through skiffle, you know, so she actually is at the intersection of all these things. And also she doesn't become famous till she's old.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's an interesting thing that sometimes happens. And if you're a stickler, then like get in your craw, but you know, so, someone like Elizabeth Cotton, who, yes, these songs she wrote when she was very young, we're talking like the early 20th century, when she was writing these big songs, but they were not popular until, you know, the Seeger family kind of amplified her music. But by then it was the early 60s. So even though the music dates back certainly from the era that this category is used to, it was not really heard until the quote unquote rock era. And so it's like complicated.
They should call it early influence.
Yeah, right. Let's just, we should take every inductee and see how many earlies they earn. But then like, I don't know. It's like, we had a conversation about Harry Belafonte last week, who, you know, his influence on rock and roll really was not musical. It's like, if you are
cultural
and political, if you're to find the most meaningful influences, and that's kind of unusual for, I mean, like, I guess you could make the argument, you know, someone maybe like Pete Seeger, whose, you know, political message was maybe had more of a profound impact on rock and roll than the music. But with Belafonte, it's like Calypso, there was a time when that was positioned as the opposition to rock and roll.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it's kind of, like you said, Kristen, it's the side category. It's kind of shuffling someone in. And let's not forget, and this is easy to forget, but Sister Rosetta Tharpe was on the ballot that year.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which is unusual.
That's very strange, because she is so clearly early influence in the sense that they have used the category before.
You see that and you're immediately like, well, I guess that's nice, maybe in terms of visibility for a longer period of time, becomes part of the discussion when the ballot goes out. But you kind of knew that she was going to be put in as an early influence.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not, you know, a violation of the category really by any means. It's actually a good one and should have been way earlier.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about kind of where this category could go, the different avenues we could go down. We could spend, I don't know, 100 hours talking about it, given how broad the category has become. But before we do that, let's take a quick break. And then when we come back, we'll get deeper into the early influence category. So we'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. We hope you had a nice break. We hope over your break, you
made sure your cats were all right.
Made sure they were safe and sound. Okay, so this early influence category, there's a lot of places it could go, especially with it being kind of blown up last year. So we maybe should give some context as to where this has been. We have an episode that is kind of about the history of the category that I would say is a great resource. We re-ran it a few weeks ago, but if you haven't listened to that, that is with an unrelated Elijah Wald.
Oh, Elijah, yeah. We call each other cousins. We're not related. We like to call each other cousins.
Yeah, but you know, this category has been part of the Rock Hall since the beginning of the inductions, and they used to use it quite liberally in the beginning. There would be three or so early influence inductees every year for the first, you know, dozen years or so of the Rock Hall, and then it started to fade away. And then we would see it every few years. You know, by the time Sister Rosetta was inducted, there hadn't been an early influence inductee since 2015. So, you know, it was every few. And now, though, there has been some sort of shift, which is good, to utilize these side categories more than usual. We had three last year, we have two this year. So, and we had said before they had changed it, do at least one a year. Like, we know you're not going to devote that much time to it at the ceremony anyway. Yep. It's not going to affect things. Like, just, and there's such a rich backlog of artists that you can induct here. Just do some, and they are doing some now, to their credit. So,
yeah, to their credit, good for them.
Whatever, man. So, like, when we talk about where this could go, even using the old definition of this category, and like a lot of the inductees for early influence were like old blues artists, like pre-rock blues guitar guys. There's still like a ton of those that could, if you wanted to just stick with that very strict, narrow definition. And like what I did was I just like looked at the Blues Hall of Fame and looked at their first class. And like, there's a lot of overlap, but there's still a number of artists, whether it's Big Bill Brunzy, Lightnin' Hopkins, Son House, Blind Lemon Jefferson, Memphis Minnie, and either Sonny Boy Williamson, which there is a one and two. They are not father and son. They are just different guys. So there's like plenty to draw from that category. I think the most exciting of those would be Memphis Minnie, just because we're used to dudes, but to get a woman in there would be atypical and, you know, was unusual. And, you know, would be something to celebrate.
Wouldn't that be something?
Have you talked about the word influence? I mean, maybe it's just me, but the word influence is so complicated. You know, influence is a word that has to refer to the more important thing, right? It's by definition, influence means like it's kind of subordinated in some way. I mean, like it kind of is singled out as like, this is the thing that helped this thing happen. And so that makes it seem, but there's a way that influence is really just rolling out the red carpet for the other thing. There's a way I could never get past the word influence. Cause it, again, it's all about like, what
did it lead to? It influenced.
Yeah. And what? I mean, this is kind of a, you know, this was a thing I thought a lot about when I was writing about Rosetta Tharpe. At some point, you know, how do you write a book about someone like Rosetta Tharpe and not have it be about she influenced Elvis and Johnny Cash and Bob Dylan or whatever?
How do you make it that she herself was enough and not what she led to important or somehow more meaningful?
Because those are the bigger names. And so how do you do that? And kind of ignite, like, and that's an important piece of the story without like somehow like doing the same thing in your own storytelling. I remember early on when I was like, I don't know if I can write a whole book about Rosetta Tharpe. There's not enough information about her. And I was talking to someone who was like in the book business and you could write something about like Rosetta Tharpe to, at the time, this dates it, you know, to Courtney Love or something. And I was like, no, that's not.
Interesting.
That it would have to crescendo into something that people know about or something like that. So anyway, I get stuck on influence. It's like, we just got to work with these words, but it's a bad word.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And when it comes down
to master, even would be like, I don't know. Master's a terrible word too.
But yeah. Another like, one. Yeah.
Worth pointing out the original designation for this category was forefathers.
Ew. Whoa. Wow. Forefathers and sidemen. What have we wrought?
Right. Yeah.
Let's all right, take so influences it. Is a major upgrade.
Yeah, so that's not good. Well, that's the other, the musical excellence category used to be called sidemen.
Oh.
Yeah. So there, it was completely gendered for both of these.
Sorry, I got us off track, but.
No, this is helpful and important.
No. Yeah, right. Because I mean, it's worth pointing out, like, when you look at the influence for some of these, and, you know, it's been pointed out before that Robert Johnson to pick an example, was an artist who was not particularly popular or influential in his time. His real significance comes down to the fact that when the kind of British guitar nerds rediscovered his music much later, then that's for the Rock Hall made him a first year early influence inductee.
Dang.
Thank you, Elijah Wald, for telling that story. You know?
Yeah.
It's a little it's actually, now that you say it, it's a little Libba-Cotton-ish in the sense that, yeah, it was like the same generation that discovered her.
Mm-hmm.
Except that she, well, I'm sorry, I'm getting us on Libba-Cotton again, but she wasn't even, I mean, Robert Johnson was a professional entertainer, right? And we know from work like Elijah Wald's that like he had this giant repertoire that when he recorded, what we have is maybe just a tiny, tiny slice of what he did, the blues work that he did, right? So that even like kind of the way that he gets categorized as a blues player maybe obscures the kind of wide repertoire, the kind of work that he did. But Libba-Cotton's complicated because she was not an entertainer. She made music for herself. Mm-hmm. And I don't, you know, from the interviews that she did, it doesn't seem like she was unhappy with what happened later in her life, but she never set out to be an entertainer. So it's even like a layer more complicated. So anyway.
Right. Yeah. It also kind of comes down to where is this person going to fit in the Rock Hall based on the system that's set up now. You put Elizabeth Cotton on the ballot, she's not going to get the votes. She's a relatively obscure figure in comparison to Eminem and Duran Duran. You know, it's like putting her on that same ballot is laughable. I guess
maybe to you. But for me, I mean, and all the other cotton heads out there.
You know, so it's like, all right, then do we create new categories or do we try to fit these artists into the pre-existing ones? Just hope nobody gets too pedantic about it.
I have a Duran Duran story.
Oh, please. Yeah.
It's not about a snore, though. It's not.
Okay.
No, well, all right.
So I'll see if I can stay awake for it then. I'm done.
My family moved to England for a year, and I saw Duran Duran at De Montfort Hall in Leicester, England.
Ooh.
And then when I came back to the US, I had a Duran Duran t-shirt. And it was like thought of like I was so avant-garde.
Wow.
And then my mother, I guess when we were on, this is not as good a story as the snore, which was really a marginal story already. But my mother went to the beach or something. This was in England. And because she had a teenager who liked Duran Duran, this was before Duran Duran was famous in the US. Anyway, my American mother runs into Simon Le Bon somewhere, but knows who he is.
Amazing.
No one in the US knows who he is. And so she sent me all these pictures because he wasn't being mobbed at places. So she has I have all these pictures of my mom and Simon Le Bon.
And those are pictures that were taken on a film camera, I'm sure.
On a film camera. And I just rediscovered them the other day. I was like, oh, that's Simon Le Bon. He's a friend of my mom's.
Yeah, I can relate to this story because I too spent a year living in England.
Okay. We don't need to hear about this.
And I never talk about it.
Comes up a lot. It's instant cred for Kristen.
Look, I just lived abroad and I don't know if you can tell. it's probably clear in my countenance, but you know, I've lived
in London. I lived in Leicester.
I lived in London and I lived in Edinburgh. You know, I'm cultured. All right. Moving on. Riveting stories over.
Well, you know, speaking of Great Britain and kind of what we were talking about, the fact that like if Eric Clapton and Ronnie Wood liked you, then you're like a good candidate for this early influence, at least, or you would have been in like kind of the traditional early days of this category. There's so many to go through. We won't get lost, but Arthur Big Boy Crudup, Leroy Carr, Wynonie Harris, Roy Brown, we could lose hours, but that alone is one way to populate this category. But you can go to other genres too, like for example, jazz.
That's right.
You know, obviously part of how we define rock and roll, it's like the blending of a lot of different genres. And the Hall has gone to the jazz well, before for this category, and usually they tend to go with the big names, but I'm surprised Ella Fitzgerald has not. That just seems like such And then another one, Sarah Vaughan.
And Sarah Vaughan, even more for me, even more than Ella Fitzgerald, but Ella Fitzgerald, like, it's the thing is, if you ask musicians who they listen to, you don't necessarily hear it overtly in their music, but I don't know how much anyone ever talks to musicians about this, because you hear, you know, rock musicians saying, you know, like, my favorite singers were Sarah Vaughan and Frank Sinatra, you know, and that's who I wanted to be, even though I was doing something different from what they were doing, but that's what I had in mind, whether that's a kind of sound quality or a kind of charisma or whether it's whatever it is. And right, like, so that it's kind of really surprising that those two vocalists, Ella Fitzgerald and Sarah Vaughan, or even a Memphis Minnie, I'm thinking of like some of these women, like, because I feel like musicians have big ears, you know, and they listen to all kinds of things, and they get put in boxes, but they don't listen in boxes.
Right. Yeah. And it's that trickiness with the influence. Like, how do you define it? Like, does it have to, how directly does it have to inspire the music that comes after it? And like, maybe it's a little trickier to decode. And sometimes it is easier. I mean, with like Memphis Minnie, it's kind of easy because it's like she wrote When the Levee Breaks. Levee keeps on raining, levee's going to break. Okay, I can see where that goes, how that satisfies the rockist, the more discerning rockist, who then can see, okay, I know that song, biggest rock band of all time. Like, there, right? got it. Keeps on raining, levee's going to break. Now, and someone who's come up on this show before, and this was probably Elijah Wald's biggest pick for who should be in this category, is Count Basie. And he's another person who's kind of, you could say, from the jazz side, but kind of the way he was as a band leader, and I think the what he was able to do at that in that regard kind of led to what rock and roll would become. He was like the house band on like some Alan Freed rock and roll dance party.
And here's the king of rock and roll himself, Alan Freed.
Thank you, Burn Bennett, and welcome to our Camel Rock and Roll Dance Party, starring one of the greatest names in music, the swingin'est band in the land, Count Basie and his orchestra with Joe Williams.
You know, someone who coined the term rock and roll, like Count Basie was, and his orchestra were kind of like there at the big point that, you know, made Cleveland the place for the actual museum.
Place that rocks.
But yeah, and I think also about pop, and you brought up Frank Sinatra, and that's an interesting one to try and pull apart, because he hated rock and roll, and he was very adamant about it. And when he was involved with having his own label, one of the only rules was no rock and roll.
Which, you know, what a great call. Certainly not going to sell a lot of those type of records.
I mean, on some level, it's almost like too big to fail in the terms of like, yeah, Frank Sinatra like influenced a lot of people, like no doubt, including those who he hated. But like the shadow that's cast is so long. And you wonder if that will ever be, you wonder what, because the other thing is like, what's the priority with the Hall in this category? Do they need to include someone like Frank Sinatra? What would be the point?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that I think that the category serves as reparations.
Right. Yeah.
So Frank Sinatra like doesn't work.
Yeah.
On a few levels. Yeah. A super famous dead white guy. Like,
yeah.
Like those are like the three things that I think of. It's like someone who maybe wasn't super famous, and so you can shine a light on them. Someone who doesn't fit who's not a white guy, someone who is traditionally, you know,
marginalized,
that we can kind of cast the net wider diversity wise. And then someone who's not alive, it's like, the other thing is like, try, you know, I'm thinking particularly about Harry Belafonte. Usually the inductees in this category are not living, but I do think there's got to be some priority in terms of, you look at someone like Harry Belafonte and you go, oh, he's 95 years old. you know, let's induct him while he's still with us.
Yeah. And I guess also like slightly marginal, like marginal in terms of genre, like a little too country, mm-hmm. a little too, however the categories get sliced, or the, you know, some of the folk stuff, the gospel, the folk stuff comes in that door. Bill Monroe, Jimmy Rogers.
Right. Yeah. Though, and I believe Jimmy Rogers was inducted that first year.
Yeah.
And cause he was often cited by the king himself, right. Elvis, mm-hmm. among other, I want to say like Dylan too. Like if you, it really felt like, especially in the beginning, if you had Bruce, Dylan, Elvis, Johnny Cash, like one of those big names cite you as an influence, that really felt like all it
took. The thing is, if you had asked Bruce, if you just put those four people up there, Bruce, Dylan, Johnny Cash, Elvis, they were the ones who decided influences. Actually, you'd end up having a lot more Black women.
Mm-hmm.
In the Rock Hall, because Johnny Cash would have talked about Rosetta Tharpe, Bruce Springsteen would have talked about the girl groups.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I
well, and speaking of the girl groups, I mean, is there kind of like an argument? I know that there's many of the girl groups that were skipped over and missed, and
yeah.
This might be also a good way to kind of rectify that as well.
I think it will be.
You think so?
I just don't see, I mean, the similar problem we're talking about, it's like slightly different, but you put the Marvelettes on a ballot, they're not going to be able to compete.
Oh yes, wait a minute, Mr. Postman.
The Marvelettes are not inducted?
No, they've been on the ballot twice, but they haven't been on the ballot since 2015. And they seem like a real oversight. And we're getting to a point, like if we're inducting 70s artists as early influence, like this is probably going to be the category where the Marvelettes or the Chantels or the Shangri-Las wind up.
You have the Beatles and Bruce Springsteen partly because of the Marvelettes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, if you talk about the canonical, the super canonical figures, it's really hard to think about like why that's crazy too. And a lot of those women are alive and still performing. Mm-hmm. They're around there to get their garlands. They're ready for them.
Yes.
You know, like I said, the Marvelettes they were nominated twice, 2013, 2015, oddly enough, you'd think they would have been on the ballot.
Yeah. That earlier seems quite than late. That. Yeah.
And I mentioned the Chantels. They've been on the ballot 2002, 2010. And I'll just list off the other, because that's the other thing, is that artists who've been nominated before, who I think could fit, as I'm looking at six-time nominee Chuck Willis.
Yes, see right.
Who they nominated a lot in the early days and just couldn't get through. Johnny Ace, Esther Phillips, Mary Wells, Billy Warden as Domino's, Link Wray.
Oh, Link Wray. Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
And it just never happened. And some of these were only on the ballot once or twice. And then they never came up again. Like Esther Phillips and Mary Wells were both on the ballot in 1987. And then
wow.
never
oh
again.
Oh my God. So early. Oh my gosh. And then that's it. I'm like, Mary Wells, someone I've heard of, you know what I mean? Like, dang. Mm-hmm.
The first lady of Motown, I think is what, yeah. what they called her.
There's this weird like entropy, I don't know what it is, where people, you begin to, you, Joe, you have this memorized, you know, whatever this, you probably dream about, like, you know, all the, but you start to assume like, oh, that's clearly already in. I don't even have to think about that unless you have like the whole chart in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
And then you kind of think, wow, these are kind of interesting oversights.
Yeah. That's why they need me at the nominating committee. Get me in the room.
You know, I don't know what produced Liv Cotton, but at least with Rosetta Tharpe, there was this cultural momentum,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the internet really helped to popularize her because the video of her, and we don't have that many hours of it,
mm-hmm.
but the video of her that we do have at least four or five songs, it's like so fantastic that all you have to do is show it to someone and it makes
and
sense.
Like,
so I think,
duh.
You know, YouTube really helped her circulate. And also because the videos, even if they're poor quality, you know, you can watch her play the guitar. It doesn't even matter if the sound sucks. You see what she's doing. And so it communicates something immediately. And I think there was such power to the video. Liva Cotton doesn't have that.
Mm-hmm.
So she's different. But I think with Rosetta Tharpe, it was like, that was easy. People were, you could see the clicks. You could see the number of views on YouTube right. exponentially start changing after a certain time. That helps. You know, what we need is like a cultural campaign around some of these, you know, or someone needs to do a biopic.
Yeah. Thinking along the lines of interesting footage to propel an induction, Screamin' Jay Hawkins came to mind.
Right.
Because he was, you know, kind of one of the first shock performance artists, you know, with like a bone through his nose and, you know, coming out of a coffin to this thing, I put a spell on you.
I put a spell on you.
Is Alice Cooper in the Rock Hall?
Yeah. He got in.
And then Screamin' Jay Hawkins is not? Okay.
Well, you know, it was from what Bob Merlis told us, who was on the nominating committee, when they were talking about Kiss, he was like, no Alice Cooper before Kiss. But really, it should have been no Screamin' Jay Hawkins before Alice Cooper.
Yeah.
You know, you keep going back, but they kind of stopped at Alice. And Screamin' Jay Hawkins wasn't, you know, necessarily like a early, you know, pre-rock act, but like, this is where, if you were 50s, 60s, this is where you go now. And, you know, same with, you know, kind of Big Mama. She could have been inducted as a performer in those early classes, but Big Mama is like, she's the one.
She is such a huge oversight that I cannot.
If I got a ticket to just like put someone through early influence, I'm just shocked she's never come up.
Really? She's never come up?
Never on any of those ballots in the early days. And then like, now you would put her in early influence, but it's just not, we haven't seen it. I don't know what,
you maybe, know, maybe this Elvis biopic, movie. I hate to freaking say it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, honestly, you know what, for all Elvis took from Black women, maybe it's time he finally gives a little something back.
Against his will after his
death. Against his will after his death and without his consent or permission, which also means against his will.
Well, Big Mama was pretty vocal about how she did not feel like Elvis really gave also, up the credit.
Janis Joplin, you know, there's other people who.
Mm-hmm. And she did.
Talked about her.
Janis took Big Mama like on the road and stuff. And yeah, I know that.
So it's like, if you had asked some of these artists, you know, they would insist, I imagine Janis Joplin would have insisted on that. That's a weird one. You know, that's a weird, bad oversight. One thing I can say, because I teach this stuff in a classroom, is, you know, that again, there's not a lot of great footage. Mm-hmm. There's actually not a lot of great footage of Big Mama Thornton. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for a world now where, you know, you have to go right to the internet and find the information that you need, there's not as much of her that was recorded, or the footage of her doing Hound Dog is in like a European TV show. And so it's kind of canned. You know, she's also touring Europe, right? And in the blues, gospel, R&B tours of the late 50s and 60s. So, you know, they're kind of weirdly staged performances. Mm-hmm. The performers are kind of put up there as a little bit like naives rather than as sophisticated entertainers. But again, I don't know, but I think you're right. I think the Elvis biopic might, you get a bunch of young people saying, I didn't know about this person, which they don't. Why would they know? It's, you know, 100 years old to them. You know, my parents said to me that my parents are in their 80s and they said, Gail, did you know that there was this person, Big Mama something, who did the song that Elvis did?
What?
And like, yeah, I knew that. But, you know, like, I don't know. They didn't know that. Most people don't know that.
Yeah. How would they, you know, unless they were interested and looked into it. Sometimes it takes a cultural moment. I mean, we haven't talked about this and this is kind of off topic, but I think Kate Bush is getting into the Rock Hall next year.
Yeah. Oh my God. I just was thinking about that. I was thinking about that this week, Joe.
Do you know running up that hill
is like the number one song.
Number four on the Hot 100.
Yeah.
Like not amazing. Just. It's, we might be looking at Outkast and Kate Bush getting in.
Well,
anyone who's under 50 to pay any attention, you know, they're going to have to start thinking about this stuff.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, the best part about it is that she released a statement, you know, a classic Notes app statement.
She did. That. Yeah. I saw she's going to do an interview, which that alone is like,
it's amazing
news, big news. If like within now and the time the ballots come out, she and Big Boy released the music they've been working on. I don't know. It's just, it could really be something.
I really hope that that music is good too.
Yeah.
Big boy. Oh boy. You know, I've enjoyed some of Big Boy's like side projects that he's done with other artists. He did one with Fantagram. Keep the lights on. Liked some of those songs and stuff. So I think he's very talented. And of course I love Kate Bush and I love Outkast. And I just, you know, I hope that this moment lives up to its potential, you mm-hmm. know?
Yeah. But back on topic, you know, I just want to put out there a few more names that were from the early days, not exactly pre-rock, but probably fit in this category now and have never been nominated. When Seymour Stein would come on our show, he would always talk about Ivory Joe Hunter. He would talk about the Clovers and he would talk about Connie Francis. Mm. He also would talk about the last time he was on the show, we talked about Pat Boone and we were like, no, okay.
Okay.
Interesting.
This might be the last time you're on our show.
It's kind of important.
I know. And he made a good argument.
Yeah.
He seems so not rock and roll
to me.
I asked actually our Twitter followers who they thought should be in. And a lot of the names that I mentioned already came up, as did, you know, Dick Dale.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which is a strange omission. And he could fit in this category. Sad he was with us until a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And we could have included him. And, you know, it would have meant something because I know his final years were not easy. He was ill and still on the road because he had to be that kind of thing.
He had to perform, yeah.
But also, you know, Johnny Burnett and the Rock and Roll Trio. You know, an interesting one is Odetta. If you kind of look on the folk side of things, as we do with this category.
Well, Belafonte's in.
Yeah.
Libba Cotton's in. Bob Dylan's in.
Yeah, it feels
the
like
the Venn diagram of Odetta, you know.
Overlap, yeah. Absolutely. And then there's also the Kraftwerk Gil Scott Heron style inductions, especially Kraftwerk, like putting an artist
we're going to see next weekend live. Like,
yeah, we are seeing Kraftwerk.
We are seeing in 2 weeks.
In a few weeks. And I'm very excited. It's going to be 3D. But what I mean is like Kraftwerk were on the ballot 6 times. And then it just was like, we need to get them in somehow. Let's use early influence. Musical excellence tends to be the catch-all for artists that can't get in through the normal means, but like MC5 and New York Dolls, you could position them as punk early influences, even though, you know,
and I think they will be positioned in that way soon. I guess to me, I'm like, before we do all this newfangled inducting, I'm like, let's really pay homage to the people who are really going to get left behind when we start modernizing this category. I just mean like literally like doo-wop singers of the 40s and 50s, you know, like that kind of style. Also, you know, Leslie Gore, someone who we've talked about before. It's my party and I'll cry if I want to, cry if I want to. I think she has a early influence argument to be made. It's just like almost anybody from the mid 60s and before could just kind of like, they could do just a big old sweep, a big old induction, you know, and like there could be like a fun package about it, maybe a big tribute performance to all of these artists, maybe almost through the decades from the, you know, 1890s through the 60s or whatever, you know, however they want to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I mean, like there's, you know, the Golden Gate Quartet. Swing down, chariot, stop, and let me ride. Or like all these like vocal groups, the Penguins, like just going back, there is so much work to be done probably prior to 1940. You know what I mean? Yes. And we're already moving the goalposts into the 60s and 70s.
That's exactly. And this pressure that I'm sure the people who have to make these decisions feel, but also the weird social pressure on the artist. Like somehow, if you get to the part where you're eligible, like it's some insult to you if you're not in the first, like this weird expectation that the best thing is to get inducted the first year you're eligible, because it really, exactly, it kind of perpetuates this presentism, and we just get away from, like, we just leave all of it behind.
But luckily, we're the only people who are paying attention to when people become eligible.
Yeah.
We're also the only people paying attention to who gets in which category. Like, nobody knows LL Cool J got into a side category last year. That's just, you know, people get inducted and then they're considered inducted.
He was musical excellence.
He was. Because he was just, it was clear he was not getting in through the ballot. And
he had been nominated seven times.
You know, and I guess all we ask is that these inductees get some time at the ceremony. We know it's not going to be a lot. It's kind of a bummer that Charlie Patton, he just got a kind of dirgy performance from Gary Clark Jr. and nothing else. You didn't really get a sense of who he was and why he was important. And so, you know, that's really all we can ask. And things like, and again, I know Kristen hates the phrase "to the Hall's credit," but something like Elizabeth Cotton is without a doubt, like, it is raised her profile, just the announcement, let alone whatever the induction will look like. It's, you know, you highlight artists. That's what this category should do, to get people to know about these artists that they wouldn't have known about otherwise. You know, it seems like there's always one of someone who definitively was from the pre-rock era that we can say that this induction helped to shine a light on their life and music. Any closing thoughts, Gail?
No, so next year you're going to be talking to someone about Big Mama Thornton.
Let's hope so.
Right?
Yeah.
Bringing it in to reality. Yeah.
Right. We can put the flag in the ground now that, you know, this is the prediction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've definitely been predicting her.
Positive thinking.
Every year. Positive thinking. Gail, thank you so much for joining us. This was really great.
Thank you. It was nice to talk to both of you.
Yes.
And I want to give you the opportunity. I know you have some writing out there that people should check out. Certainly the Sister Rosetta Tharpe book. Here's your opportunity to plug away.
No, I'll plug away the Sister Rosetta Tharpe book, coming out in a new edition from Beacon in 2023 with a new preface and a new afterword that kind of tells the story from 2007 to yesterday.
Ooh.
And the name of that book is Shout, Sister Shout.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, look out for that. The untold story has become told. And Gail will continue
untold
to tell
story.
It.
Yes. Told once again.
And of course, our listeners know they can follow us at RockhallPod on Twitter and Instagram. RockhallPod@gmail.com is the email. If you want Kristen to see that, you need to designate that somewhere in your message. Otherwise, I'm not going to send it. She doesn't want to read it. Chicago folks, we have live dates. I will be at the Lincoln Lodge on the 29th of June at 7:30. That is a Wednesday. It'll be stand up and other stuff. And Kristen, you'll be at the
Paper Machete on July 9th at 3:00 at the Green Mill.
Midwest. And of course, subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts. Rate and review us 5 stars only. Thank you to Mike Lloyd for the logo. Thank you to Yusu Kim for the music. And thank you to Pantheon Podcasts for hosting us. I'm Joe Quazala.
I'm Kristen Studdard.
And who cares
about the Rock Hall?